From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Trump elicited laughter at the United Nations headquarters on Tuesday when he began his speech by making wild claims about the impact of his presidency on the United States. News media are saying he went off script during his boastful opening. The speech was more of a State of the Union address to an international audience rather than the expected words of global cooperation and diplomacy. A large part of his speech involved Trump attacking Iran, which UN Ambassador Nikki Haley had earlier said was to be the main focus of his appearance. After he spoke, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani took to the microphone and accused the U.S. of waging economic war against Iran through sanctions. A year after his first appearance at the United Nations, how did Trump do on this global arena? And how has U.S. foreign policy changed, if at all, under his presidency? Joining me to analyze Trump's speech at the UN this week is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So I cannot resist but play the first part of Trump's speech for you and our audience, where he literally was laughed at. And this is in part significant because he had always accused other presidents of making the U.S. the laughingstock of the world. Here is what Trump said and the response he got in his opening.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
And that was President Donald Trump at the United Nations on Tuesday, eliciting laughter at in this global arena after basically saying that he had had a bigger impact on the U.S. than almost any other president in U.S. history. Rahul Mahajan, this to me was actually the sort of least surprising thing that we've seen in this news cycle. 2 years ago, if someone had said Trump was going to be president, you and I would probably have responded, he's going to make us a laughingstock of the world. And that sort of literally happened on Tuesday, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, they could have been responding to several things. I mean, they can tell, of course, that domestically, his administration has accomplished very little, even in terms of, you know, the larger goals of the right wing. Yes, they've done a great job of finding every non-white person they can kick out of the country and kick them out, and of terrorizing every non-white person who comes into the country. And sure, they passed some tax cuts, but they haven't actually been very effective. But I think more importantly, there's a general recognition, even stronger, considerably stronger than it was at the height of the Bush mania, that the United States is no longer even pretending to stand for anything in the world, to stand for any kind of exalted notion of human rights, human progress, or even human decency. And so there's a twofold response from countries that believe that they do stand for those things, or that are trying to stand for them. There is complete contempt, and for countries whose administrations are, you know, doing similar things, there is liberation and freedom, and the ability to not have to worry about what the United States is going to say or do.
Oh, so he did move on quickly to the U.S.'s role in the world, and of course, a big part of it was the attack on Iran. But before we get to that, I want to play what he said about Saudi Arabia, because, of course, for those people who are, you know, who have been actually paying attention to who the main sponsors of, say, terrorism are on the international stage, Saudi Arabia is a country that comes up often. But Trump, like his predecessors, has applied a very different standard to Saudi Arabia. This is what he had to say.
Following my trip to Saudi Arabia last year, The Gulf countries opened a new center to target terrorist financing. They are enforcing new sanctions, working with us to identify and track terrorist networks, and taking more responsibility for fighting terrorism and extremism in their own region. The UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar have pledged billions of dollars to aid the people of Syria and Yemen, and they are pursuing multiple avenues to ending Yemen's horrible, horrific civil war.
And that is President Trump at the United Nations on Tuesday speaking about how Saudi Arabia and the UAE are helping to end the Yemen war. It's interesting, he also threw Qatar in there in the earlier part of his remarks. Qatar briefly became enemy of the U.S., but now seems to be off the hook. Rahul, can you analyze what he just said? It seems as though the opposite is true, at least where Yemen is concerned.
Well, let's get to Yemen in a second, but first I tried, after seeing this, tried desperately to find any information about what the terrorism financing targeting center is up to.
Huh.
And, you know, sure, there were articles about it when it was originally announced last year, but basically for the rest, if you don't look at U.S. government press releases, you will not find anything. The latest thing they did, and this is a real, you know, stunning achievement for the Trump administration, in May they decided to put on their list for targeting members of Hezbollah's Shura Council, including, of course, Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah. Now imagine the triumph in getting Saudi Arabia to agree to target financing for Hezbollah. How much money do you think goes from Saudi Arabia into Hezbollah in the first place? And how much do you think members of Hezbollah's Shura Council are hobnobbing with anybody with money in Saudi Arabia? I mean, it's a level of accomplishment that is paralleled only by his administration's accomplishments in every other sphere. Mm-hmm. With regard to Yemen, you know, it's even funnier because, in addition, of course, to the fact that Saudi Arabia's involvement has involved killing or tens of thousands and subjecting millions to severe humanitarian crisis, it is also the case that in fighting against the Houthis in Yemen, they are essentially taking the side of various al-Qaeda groups, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So Trump is lauding Saudi Arabia's continuing exactly to take the same sort of positions it does with regard to various kinds of extremist groups that it has before, except that now Trump thinks that he's somehow gotten them to do something different.
So he also then referred briefly to the Syria war, which is one of the worst wars that we've had in the region in the past few years, with Yemen coming closest, perhaps. This is what Trump had to say about Syria.
The ongoing tragedy in Syria is heartbreaking. Our shared goals must be the de-escalation of military conflict, along with a political solution that honors the will of the Syrian people. In this vein, we urge the United Nations-led peace process be reinvigorated. But rest assured, the United States will respond if chemical weapons are deployed by the Assad regime.
And that is President Trump speaking at the United Nations about Syria on Tuesday. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire correspondent for our program. Rahul, to the point where he sort of started talking about the UN peace process, it all sounded fairly reasonable. And then he threw out this condition about the U.S. responding in case of a chemical attack. We know that Assad has launched chemical attacks on his people many times. There are some people on the left who would argue against that reality, but it's been the case. What do you make of what he said on Syria?
Well, I guess to start with, this is one area where it's hard to give him a lower grade than Obama. I mean, I think this, except for the verbiage, could have been said just as well in an address by President Obama to the General Assembly. What I have to say is, I don't think it's a bad idea to warn against chemical attacks. The problem only is that focusing on chemical attacks makes it very clear, as it has been since for at least 6 years now, that Assad has impunity in doing whatever else he wishes. It's funny to pivot from the entire rest of the speech, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, which is sort of heralding a new Westphalian era where national sovereignty is the only principle that matters in international relations, to talking about a peace process that is supposed to impose some kind of settlement on a regime that claims to be the representative of a sovereign nation and that has no reason to actually back down, since there's no way effectively for the rebels and whatever support they have to allow them to prevail at this point.
So now we get to the part of the speech that involves Iran, which was to be the sort of main focus of U.S.'s, and this the sort of new chapter of U.S. foreign policy is targeting Iran. And we, of course, know that just days before this U.N. speech, there was a brutal attack on Iran's military with an armed gunman shooting and killing nearly 30 people in Avaz in Iran. And the Iranian government blamed U.S.-supported regimes. There has been an organization that took responsibility, and many worry that Iran would respond quite violently. It's not clear if the U.S. was involved in that or not. But let's listen to some of what Trump said about Iran at the United Nations.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction. They do not respect their neighbors or borders, or the sovereign rights of nations. Instead, Iran's leaders plunder the nation's resources to enrich themselves and to spread mayhem across the Middle East and far beyond. The Iranian people are rightly outraged that their leaders have embezzled billions of dollars from Iran's treasury, seized valuable portions of the economy, and looted the people's religious endowments, all to line their own pockets and send their proxies to wage war. Not good. Iran's neighbors have paid a heavy toll for the region's agenda of aggression and expansion. That is why so many countries in the Middle East strongly supported my decision to withdraw the United States from the horrible 2015 Iran nuclear deal and reimpose nuclear sanctions. The Iran deal was a windfall for Iran's leaders. In the years since the deal was reached, Iran's military budget grew nearly 40%. The dictatorship used the funds to build nuclear-capable missiles, increase internal repression, finance terrorism, and fund havoc and slaughter in Syria and Yemen. The United States has launched a campaign of economic pressure to deny the regime the funds it needs to advance its bloody agenda.
And that is President Donald Trump speaking on Tuesday at the United Nations about Iran. Rahul Mahajan is my guest, joining me to analyze Trump's speech. It's interesting when you hear him talking about elites seizing big portions of the economy, the military budget going up by 40%, increased repression. One might imagine that's a description of what's happened in the U.S. under Trump. What do you think Trump's goal is with this aggressive positioning on Iran?
I don't think there is any particular international goal that is involved here. There's no sort of means-ends connection in terms of any kind of statement of policy. There is perhaps a pretense that he's going to put Iran, quote, back in the box economically and this was going to make their military spending go down. But again, it cannot possibly be based on any sort of reasonable prognostication. So let's look at this big claim, which is, first of all, very funny to castigate Iran for supposedly increasing its military budget by 40% in the same speech where he is boasting about increasing the U.S. military budget.
Right, exactly.
near 20% since Trump has come into office, and for no reason. You know, even the military doesn't know what to do with the extra money. But the truth is that if you look at, it's hard to tell because Iranian economic statistics aren't the most dependable, but roughly what it looks like is that Iran's military spending just recently has returned to its pre-Obama sanctions level. So the first thing that happened, remember, with the Obama administration is they coordinated multilateral sanctions that for the first time actually had an effect on Iran substantial enough to get Iran to consider policy changes. I'm not saying that necessarily that was the best thing, but it was the first effective policy. The Iran-Libya Sanctions Act the Republicans passed back in the 90s had very, very little effect. Whatever posturing the Bush administration did nothing except allow Iran to massively increase its influence in Iraq. It is this multilateral approach that the Obama administration took, bringing Europe in, that helped cut Iranian military spending. And naturally, the idea with concluding the deal and lifting the sanctions was that Iran would have a chance to be prosperous and that this would allow for a gradual easing of relations. It should not have been at all an idea that it was going to cut military spending or keep it at a low level, because that is not what nations that are doing well economically do. So the return to previous levels, I think, was pretty natural. And in fact, you see hints that it is ramping up further now in response to termination of the deal and to Trump's belligerent stance. So my guess is that even as the economy of Iran is really being squeezed right now, they are not cutting military spending, and they may be looking for ways to increase it. So I don't see any kind of actual goals with regard to what Iran is doing in here. It is mostly posturing. You could tell half of his speech was actually posturing against the Democrats, talking about things like socialism. What socialist country exists in the world that was supposed to be the audience for that? Cuba? I mean, it was about the Democrats. It was not about the United Nations. And I think the Iran stuff is very similar in that regard. And I just also want to mention, because you know, we don't get back into the history all the time here, that it is true that Iran's entire set of actions in Syria is utterly indefensible. But let's look at the other claims about Iran and its lack of respect for borders and its neighbors. Okay, yes, Iran has outsized influence and an outsized presence in Iraq. Why? It is because of the United States' lack of respect for Iraq's borders or sovereignty and the war and occupation. In the absence of that, Iran would not be there. Hezbollah, Lebanon. Yes, it is true that Iran supports Hezbollah and helps to provide it arms. Why is that? It's because of Israel's lack of respect for the borders and sovereignty of Lebanon, for their invasion of southern Lebanon in the early 1980s. Hezbollah would not exist without that. I mean, it's just a little bit ridiculous to make Iran, in those cases, the source of the problem.
What do you make of the attack on the military parade in Ahvaz? The attack killed nearly 30 people, and reports suggest it was a local Sunni separatist group named the Patriotic Arab Democratic Movement in Ahvaz that they actually denied doing it, but the state-run news agency credited them with the attack. So as far as you can tell, does this have anything to do with U.S.-Iran relations, or was it sort of coincidental that this happened before the U.N. meeting?
I'm honestly unable to speculate. I would say this, that my guess is there is no direct U.S. connection. As far as I'm able to figure out, the only kind of of terrorism the United States has been involved with inside Iran involves this, and, you know, very bipartisan effort to target Iran's nuclear scientists. Okay, so I don't see any percentage for the United States in getting involved in this, and I don't see any reason to believe that either the United States or any allies or proxies were involved. Beyond that, it's hard to say. I mean, is it ISIS? Is it is it this group in Avaz? We don't know enough to say at this point.
I want to play a couple more clips from Trump's speech. This is actually, let's listen to what Hassan Rouhani said in response to the Trump speech. After Trump spoke, this is what Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said. It's just one part of his speech, but I thought it was quite interesting.
It is unfortunate that we are witnessing rulers in the world who think they can secure their interests better, or at least in the short term, ride public sentiments and gain popular support through the fomenting of extremist nationalism and racism, and through xenophobic tendencies resembling a Nazi disposition, as well as through the trampling of global rules and undermining international institutions.
The Iranian President Hassan Rouhani using sentences that might have been too complicated for Trump, but was pretty clear to what the pretty clear to the rest of the international audience gathered there. He was speaking through an interpreter, of course. I thought that this was a pretty salient statement that he made, Rahul.
I don't know what to say. There's not even any overstatement. I mean, it's yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
I mean, Trump himself has absolutely opened up and invited these Nazi comparisons. He's done his best to make sure that everybody will be thinking that.
So let's now go back to, I'm trying to sort of make sense of how Trump is characterizing his foreign policy, because of course it's very important to him as a president to set himself apart from other presidents, to be the best at everything in his view. So this was, he referred to principled realism in describing the U.S.'s supposedly new approach to the world.
America's policy of principled realism means we will not be held hostage to old dogmas, discredited ideologies, and so-called experts who have been proven wrong over the years, time and time again. This is true not only in matters of peace, but in matters of prosperity. We believe that trade must be fair and reciprocal. The United States will not be taken advantage of any longer.
And that is Trump on Tuesday at the United Nations. He went on to express in various ways that no longer will the U.S. be bullied by the world. In that instance, of course, his position on trade was likely aimed at the European Union. But can you make sense of what he was saying? His assertion that he's not going to rely on so-called experts is also sort of consistent with the fact, with how he's ruled domestically, right? Expertise is anathema in Trump's America.
Yes, absolutely. And in this case, I suppose he is referring mostly to basically every economist in the country except Peter Navarro. The sad thing is, of course, many of us think that the vast majority of economists have consistently gotten some things wrong. I don't see any reason to believe that protectionism is one of those things. As for the phrase principled realism, I don't know what to say about that. It's a kind of, Henry Kissinger probably calls himself a principled realist too. What is there to make of that? I do not know. With regard to trade, it is so funny that he's constantly talking about how trade should be fair and never stopping to think, if the United States is running such a huge trade deficit, why might that be? Maybe there are many reasons you could have a trade deficit. You could be in a relationship with another country which has some resources that you need and has the ability to impose terms on you. In this case, however, the reason is that American consumers are taking advantage of the ability to get large numbers of goods from other countries at prices that are relatively low for them. The trade deficit is a sign, if anything, that the unfairness of the trade is in America's favor. But of course, he's not capable of thinking about that or of understanding anybody's explanation about that.
Well, I want to play one final clip from what Trump said at his speech at the United Nations. I was sort of disgusted by this one more so than some of the other parts of his speech. It was around the issue of global migration and the global compact on migration. You know, this issue coming at a time when we have the world's worst refugee crisis in modern history. This is what Trump had to say.
We recognize the right of every nation in this room to set its own immigration policy in accordance with its national interests. Just as we ask other countries to respect our own right to do the same, which we are doing. That is one reason the United States will not participate in the new global compact on migration. Migration should not be governed by an international body unaccountable to our own citizens.
And that is Trump speaking on Tuesday about the United Nations, at the United Nations, about the fact that the U.S. would not participate in the Global Compact on Migration because it is an international body that's unaccountable to the American people. But of course, he's made it very clear here in the U.S., right, Rahul, what he thinks of refugees in general. I mean, even going against the will of the American people and many members of Congress, he has essentially had an effective ban on refugee resettlement here in the United States. So it's very clear it doesn't seem to have much to do with a global compact and this global body.
Well, I mean, there's so many things you could say. He clearly wants policies to be in the hands of an unaccountable domestic body, which is what the Supreme Court will be if Brett Kavanaugh is appointed, rather than an unaccountable international body. He does not understand the way that that these things work. Global compacts mostly involve claims by various sovereign nations that they will voluntarily abide by some standards of decency. Maybe some of them go part of the way to actually standing by their commitments. Most of them fall somewhat short. It is mostly just a way of saying that we all recognize that there is some standard that decency would impose on questions of not just refugees in particular, but migration in general. Trump, of course, is adamantly opposed to any acceptance of the notion of decency, let alone what specific things it might impose on you. But he does not understand that the vast majority of this international governance does not involve even the slightest bit of surrender of any nation's sovereignty. It's rather an exercise of nation sovereignty in trying to get others to agree as free individuals, nations in this case, on what is the right thing to do. It's particularly funny that this is a common sort of misunderstanding among many parts of the American political spectrum, including even on the left, but Trump takes it to an extreme. And again, it comes in the same speech where he is talking about the serious crisis in Venezuela, part of which is a massive refugee crisis. Some of them undoubtedly are political refugees in the sense that they want to escape potential specific repressive efforts, but the vast majority are economic refugees who are simply unable to live anymore in Venezuela. So he says that as if it is a criticism of Venezuela, which it is, but doesn't say anything about why there should not be any standards for other countries, in this case, countries on the border, particularly Colombia, for treatment of these people who, through no fault of their own, are now in the worst possible position. It's just, again, a striking statement of his own complete callousness.
Well, Rahul, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and attempting to make some sense of the Trumpian foreign policy as displayed at the United Nations this week. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is our U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent. We've been discussing Trump's speech on Tuesday at the UN. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.